Hello, and welcome to Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm David Rogowski, and today I will be reading from Outside Magazine. After dinner, I was handed a plastic spray bottle filled with water. That's F. Scott Fitzgerald, said Hayes. They demonstrated a dishwashing technique they developed over the years that minimized time and water use. Bassett held the bowl with one hand, sprayed it with the other, then wiped it clean with half a paper towel. There was nowhere to escape the cold wind. Finally, I said, "Can I get in your truck?" Hayes spread her maps on the counter. The surveying technique was called line distance sampling, and the plan was simple. We'd walk 3 kilometers east in a straight line, then 3 clicks north, then 3 clicks west, then 3 clicks south, arriving back where we started. These perfect squares, called transects, were randomly generated by a computer. The purpose was not to count all the tortoises in the square, but only those visible from the line. Scientists would use this data to extrapolate overall numbers. Meanwhile, 4 other teams would walk different transects in the region. The teams worked 5 days on, 1 day off, during which they'd hightail it to some outposts like the closest KOA campground for a shower, laundry, and groceries. This hitch would last 6 weeks. As the team supervisors, Bassett and Hayes studied the maps to assign the next set of transects, which would include a stretch along Shadow Mountain Road, the location of the bullet-riddled car, and the 6 homicides. Hayes wondered aloud, "Who's going to walk the murder transect?" The wind blew all night and into the morning. Under cold, cloudy skies, I crawled from the back of my rented Explorer and we set out in the desert, Bassett in front and Hayes and me trailing 30 yards behind. The Mojave appears so barren from windshield burst to life once you start walking it. Barrel cacti stretch their pink quills towards the sky. I rub creosote's tiny green leaves and yellow flowers between my fingers, releasing that exquisite tannic scent of the desert after a hard rain. Hayes reflected a beam of sunlight off a mirror and into a burrow, but no one was home. I told her that in all my years of desert rambling, I'd never seen a tortoise. "We haven't seen one for the past 3 days," she said. We walked in deafening wind, up and over jagged rock piles, across sandy bajadas. Every 500 meters, Bassett and Hayes logged a waypoint. "Two at 850. Zero. No. Observer. 1, said Hayes. Bassett began to read from his GPS. 5, 1, 3, 9, 6, 4, 3, 8, 3. Hayes repeated back the digits. "Good grab." As they walked, they didn't stare at the ground beneath them so much as they scanned it. On this 6-week hitch, they were averaging 1.37 tortoises per transect, but we hadn't seen any today. "Never before has so many walked so far and looked so hard to see so little," said Bassett. A few hours in, crossing the sandy flats, Bassett called out in front of us, "Tort!" He had spotted a mottled brown shell tucked into a burrow beneath the creosote bush. Freshly dug sand had compelled him to crouch down and shine a flashlight inside. Donning rubber gloves, Hayes pulled the reptile from its hole, and I got my first look. The tortoise, about the size of my kid's bike helmet, was perfectly still and kept its head buried in its shell. Let's face it, it's not as thrilling as glimpsing a wolf in the wild, yet to actually see a desert tortoise with its prehistoric armor was a reminder of how many millions of years longer than us these things have been walking the earth. Bassett and Hayes measured the tortoise and epoxied a tiny number tag to its shell. Although the disease that killed so many turtles had peaked, handlers still treated them like COVID patients, careful not to pass anything to the next specimen they touch. "He's missing a foot," Hayes noted. They speculated that it might have been chewed off by a coyote or a feral dog. I had an urge to lay my palms over its shell, but suddenly worried that I'd somehow kill the animal, or at least badly disturb it. Hayes gently placed it back in the hole. An hour later, she found a second tortoise, this one much larger, tucked into a tiny cave on a steep, rocky slope. What I'd like to impress upon you is that both these tortoises had been invisible to the naked eye, not merely camouflaged, but underground, detectable only by skilled counters who learned to read fresh disturbance in the sand. When I pointed hopefully to a hole I'd seen, Bassett took a quick glance. "Nah, that's just a fox." Bassett and Hayes loved this work and the freedom it afforded them. They earned a good living doing this and similar field work just 6 months a year. The rest of the time they tooled around all around the West, as well as Baja and Alaska, in their truck. "I always sleep better with wheels under me," Bassett said. "With a home on your back, you can crawl into your shell. When I'm at my house, I'm overwhelmed by all the things I have to do." In the spring of 1993, tortoise biologist Pam and Craig Knowles parked their motorhome in the lot at Circus Circus on the Vegas Strip. Unlike most of their colleagues, Pam and Craig had children, a toddler and an infant, who traveled with them. That morning before their 10-hour trek, the couple had dropped the kids off with a babysitter. Then they set out on a dirt road west of the city that led past bulldozers and into creosote flats where many a new freeway would be built. The two were with their colleagues and friend Sally Olson, and all three were in the vicinity of their 40s then. They wore thrift store trousers and dress shirts to protect against the sun. Pam and Sally carried umbrellas. "I don't like the desert heat," Pam said recently. Shortly after noon that day, Sally made an odd discovery, a wad of cash that appeared to be stained with dried blood. She unrolled the paper, $38. They smelled decaying flesh, partly covered by sand, wrapped in some sort of spread with something. "At first we thought it was a dead dog," Craig said, noting that locals sometimes buried their pets here. Then Craig found a clump of long blonde hair. The coyotes had discovered the body first. Craig pulled back the quilt to reveal human bones and a woman's clothing. "There are 2 spent shotgun shells," he told me. It was clear that the woman had been dead for some time, so the trio finished their survey. They then trekked back to the car, drove to a payphone, and led the police back to the site. The cops located a skull not far from the quilt. She'd been shot through the temple, Craig said. Pam and Craig checked in with the detectives after 2 months, 6 months, a year. 30 years passed. No one claimed the woman they'd found. Several of the Shadow Mountain victims were not immediately identified. The local newspaper published a drawing of a dead man's face, not unlike the coffin portraits of the Wild West gunslingers. Beside it was a photo of his chest tattoo, which said Gia, or maybe Gio. There was a treaty to help identify him. All six victims were Latino men. The police did not take long to arrest five suspects, finding them at a nearby pot farm compound 5 days later. The sheriff said that marijuana was the driving force behind the killings, and a bizarre unintended consequence of California's 2016 decriminalization of cannabis, unlicensed weed operations have been flourishing in the Mojave and alongside them, violence. The amount of cash saved from avoiding license and regulations is massive, while the misdemeanor consequences of getting caught growing illegally can be as minimal as a $500 ticket. The desert's isolation and year-round sunshine offer ideal conditions for growing. All that's needed is water, which can be taken from an abandoned well or stolen from a city hydrant, along with protection against rival gangs. As I followed Bassett and Hayes towards civilization the next morning, we saw abandoned farms, fences made of particle board and metal stakes, shreds of plastic sheets rippling in the wind and strewn across the brush, speedboats baked on trailers with deflated tires, graffiti was scrawled on boarded up houses and broken down RVs. We found the contents of someone's home dumped onto a two-track road, a gun safe cut from the floor and pried open. We drove south towards Joshua Tree. The desert gentrified. The hardscrabble ranchettes I remember from my teenage years spent rock climbing out here sat beside new homes, brutalist rectangles of concrete, glass, and corrugated steel, as if Frank Lloyd Wright had decided to design storage units. I checked into the Safari Motor Inn, where in a paved courtyard ringed with chain-link potted cacti collected cigarette butts. When we parted the ways that night after dinner, Bassett and Hayes were still debating the murder transact. "What would you think if we assigned it to ourselves?" said Hayes. "I'd probably do it," said Bassett. On the grounds of the Mojave Desert Land Trust, a nonprofit Joshua Tree that acquires land to protect its habitat, I met Executive Director Kelly Herbinson, a woman in duck canvas coat and leather boots, her sandy hair whipping in the wind. Herbinson had been chasing tortoises for over 2 decades. She told me about her first hitch as an idealistic biologist who thought the work would allow her to connect with nature, but instead she found herself trudging along a gas pipeline near Barstow, the industrial hub of the Mojave. She was 24 and had never even seen a desert tortoise. "What the fuck did I do?" she asked herself. Herbinson warmed to the work quickly. She sold her possessions, ditched her apartment, and bought a 1989 Nissan truck with a wilderness rooftop tent. During her first stint, she camped in the desert with 2 dozen turtle counters for 3 months. "It was like meeting my family for the first time," she said. "They lived the way people are meant to live, walking all day through the most beautiful landscapes. It was physically challenging, and we cared deeply for one another. We stumbled into this magical thing." But tort world changed. A year after an animal's 1990 listing threatened to shut down new construction around Las Vegas, builders and agencies engineered a swap. Public lands near the city would be developed, while lands further afield were protected as habitat. The critters themselves would be picked up, delivered to a conservation center at the city limits, then translocated to the sticks. The plan succeeded for builders, but largely failed for the tortoise. At the conservation center, which some turtle counters referred to as a concentration camp, thousands of animals that tested positive for the illness were euthanized, and in 2013 it closed due to budget cuts. Nevertheless, mitigation became a common practice among developers and land managers. Construction could proceed as long as they hired a crew of counters to remove the tortoises from the building sites, and the pay for doing so was more than twice as much as walking line distance. Turtle counters could earn $1,000 per day on the construction projects while living on the cheap. "There weren't motel types," Herbinson told me. Why would you be when you have a sweet truck? After about a decade counting turtles for what felt like the benefit of the species, Herbinson took a job on the site of one of the nation's more ambitious solar energy projects, the Ivanpah Generation Station near the Nevada-California border. The year was 2011. Threat of global warming was urgent, and the promise of renewable energy seduced just about everyone on the left up to President Barack Obama. Even as she knew the project would tear up miles of tortoise habitat, she wanted to help save them. Soulful wandering was replaced with the grim monitoring of smoke-belching road graders. Instead of just counting tortoises, now we were attaching radio transmitters and clearing them out of their homes. I was watching the bulldozers mow down Joshua trees and then collapse the empty burrows, thinking, "This can't be the solution to climate change," Herbinson said. The 14-hour days were taxing. A lot of politicians doing ribbon cutting, she remembered, and calling it a win for green energy. But within a few years, Herbinson, like many of her co-workers, was able to buy a house, hers near Joshua Tree. We have to stop losing land, Herbinson said. The tortoises are never going to survive if we keep destroying biodiversity. She explained that the fossil fuel and electrical companies won't support less destructive and less lucrative strategies like rooftop solar panels that allow homeowners to sell back to the grid, hence large projects like Avanpah. The only way we can make renewables is if the energy corporations get rich. I think the desert tortoises will be extinct in 100 years, she said. We have 10 years to save them. Paul Frank texted me a story headline. Body identified 31 years after biologists found remains in Nevada desert. The article detailed how a woman was found on what was then still the outskirts of Vegas, where Tropicana Avenue petered into two track and cut across miles of sage and yucca, prime tortoise habitat. Police called her Jane Tropicana Doe. She was found in 1993, and the coroner ruled that she'd been murdered in 1991. In early 2024, with DNA testing, she was identified as Linda Sue Anderson. This was the body Pam and Craig had found so many years ago. After I saw Anderson's daughter interviewed by a Las Vegas reporter, I looked her up. Inside, I'm dying, Mikhail told me on one of our subsequent Zoom calls. I want to go into a corner, into a fetal position. She wanted her mother's murder solved, and she was tormented. I'm hoping they did hit her good the first time so she didn't have to suffer, she said, referring to the two shotgun shells that Pam and Craig had found alongside Linda's body. The rest was just out of anger. I think about how scared she must have been. Mikhail had long, dark, curly hair and easy smile despite her grief. She was married and living in Canada when I reached her. All those years, decades, a lifetime, wondering where your mom is, why she won't talk to you, come to your wedding, meet her grandchildren, only to learn that the whole time she'd been dead, murdered, left to the coyotes, and buried in a Potter's Field cemetery in Las Vegas called the Garden of Hope. Up to now, I'd thought this was a story about a bunch of eccentric nomads. As for the bodies they came upon, I'd adopted their somewhat hard-boiled attitude that it was part of the job. I hadn't anticipated finding a grieving daughter at the end of the road, but now it hit me. Though I could not fathom Mikhail's grief, I could imagine something like it, having laid my own baby boy into a coffin some years before. Even as I set out for California, my second son, who was 4, had just spent 2 nights in the hospital with viral pneumonia, tangled up in oxygen and IV tubes, and I wept beside his bed, his brother's spirit never far. I'm haunted by kids separated from their parents, mothers from their babies. I had to joke around that my own mom blocked me, Mikhail said. She managed to smile at this memory. I wanted her to be happy and live the life she wanted to live, even if it wasn't with me. Mikhail had never given much thought to desert tortoises, and now considered how their fragile existence was somehow connected to her mother's fate. Maybe without them, she wouldn't have been found. At dawn, I cleared out of the Safari Motor Inn and drove towards Nevada. Before me, the pale moon beamed atop San Gorgonio Mountain, while in the mirror, the fat sun rolled over the 29 Palms Highway. Joshua trees glimmered in the first rays of light. A text from Bassett. We got through the scary zone in one piece. One of our crews watched a pot grow get busted with helicopters and the whole works, through binoculars, not far from the murder site. It's a Wild West for sure. At a shadeless gas station in Barstow, a hatchback parked at the pump in front of me had all its cargo covered in black plastic, either because the roof leaked or because the driver was transporting a dead body. I drove northeast into Nevada. Dust devils drove up from the flats. The desert is even sparser now. I wound through blooming yellow flowers of the Amargosa Valley and over Brown Mountain Pass, where a snow-covered peak came surprisingly into view. Coasted into Pahrump Valley, less than 50 miles from Vegas, but resonant with an empty desert feeling. At a T in the road, I met a pair of sun-beaten desert denizens. Kevin Emmerich, a former ranger at Death Valley National Park, and Laura Cunningham, a biologist and one-time turtle counter. Both are now activists who co-founded the nonprofit Basin and Range Watch, which works to conserve California and Nevada deserts. Gray hair spilled from their wide-brimmed hats. We crossed the road to a chain-link fence topped with barbed wire. Inside, the silent radiance of hundreds of solar paddles tilted toward the sun. There it is, said Cunningham, the monstrosity. The 3,000-acre Yellow Pine solar project expected to power 100,000 homes. To be sure, the electricity won't go to nearby Las Vegas. The customers are in California, where strict environmental laws push industry elsewhere. San Bernardino County has even banned large-scale solar projects. So the energy firms are coming to Nevada, providing its polarized politicians a rare chance to agree. Republicans like energy and Democrats love solar. The panels whirred and clicked as they adjusted to the dropping sun. Emmerich and Cunningham were in an even lonelier position than the average Earth activist. These solar farms were supported by the Sierra Club, the Nature Conservancy, and the National Resource Defense Council, in part because the lands, which are close to other developments, were deemed to have lower ecological value. More broadly, the rush to build solar in this part of the desert makes sense when you consider that 28 million people, 8% of Americans, live in Southern California and Las Vegas. Everyone wins, except the tortoise. Emmerich told me that during pre-construction of Yellow Pine, which coincided with historic drought, 139 tortoises were moved across the highway. The animals don't immediately dig new burrows, tortoises maintain a wide berth from one another, and aren't welcomed into new territory. Often they simply try to walk home, exposing themselves to predators. We tracked a translocated male that walked 20 miles in 2 weeks, then hit the fence, Cunningham said. 33 of the moved tortoises were killed by badgers. Each year, their territory dwindles and so do their numbers. I spoke to Patrick Donnelly from the Center of Biological Diversity. For the biologists working with the developers, the mitigation industrial complex, as he calls it, Donnelly has little patience. He's also dubious of any county that isn't paired with protection. If the desert tortoises goes extinct, it would be the best studied extinction in history. Pam and Craig Knowles offered to meet with Linda's daughters. I gathered them on a Zoom call. Pam and Craig are in their late 60s and early 70s, now raising bison in Montana. Their children are grown. The Australian Shepherd made its way briefly onto the screen. Pam and Craig recounted the story of finding Linda. Dulcina, now in her 40s with sharp features and straight black hair pulled back with a headband, told us how she got in the news. She was on a play date with both her children when a call came from the Clark County coroner. Must be about Linda, was her first thought. Linda was identified when her DNA was matched with her brother, Mikhail, and Dulcina's uncle. Mikhail said that Linda's five other siblings had died young. The sisters no longer had any connection to Las Vegas, and they planned to exhume their mom and bring her to Washington State, where they both now live. I'm sad my brother isn't here, said Dulcina. He was so little and didn't get the help and understanding. He wasn't able to know this, to know he wasn't abandoned. We've had a lot of loss, Mikhail said. As a nurse, helping others has helped me heal. Dulcinea added that all the siblings had careers that involved caring for others. We're very proud of this. And your mother would be too, said Pam. You found our mom, Mikhail told them, and you took care of her. We really appreciate it. There's a quick jump from Pahrump through Spring Mountains to a commanding view of the Eiffel Tower and the Empire State Building, down to the valley where billboards shouted, New homes at desert's edge, in a sea of two-story stucco cubes roofed with terracotta, spaced about 3 feet apart. I crossed 5 miles of Starbucks and Jamba Juices, punctuated by a big blue IKEA, to reach the corner of Tropicana and Durango, where decades before any of the surrounding suburbia was built, Linda Sue Anderson was found. The six-lane boulevards hummed as they intersected. The remote piece of desert that Pam and Craig Knowles had traversed was now a strip mall with a pin-up nail bar and Island Pacific Seafood Market done in mustard and coral. There was no open land where a tortoise might dwell or a killer might bury a body. The Filipino fish market piped in Asian pop music and sold banana leaves stuffed with sticky sweet rice and whole lechon, a smooth-roasted red piglet billed as crispy-licious. Of the turtles and the bodies in the desert, the biologist Tim Shields had told me, I think of the contrast between these ancient, highly attuned desert organisms, fully dialed into how to survive, and then these crazy monkeys round, offing each other. Tortoises are completely sane because they can't survive without being solely focused on it. We're so pampered with resources, and we just piss things away. That night, I walked a six-mile transect through Las Vegas. I didn't see any tortoises. I saw a man in a wheelchair holding a trash bag of aluminum cans with his teeth. I saw astroturf coated with dust like it needed to be watered. A billboard read, Injured while searching for dead bodies in Lake Mead. Demand compensation? I crept into electric tunnel of Fremont Street where the sky was blotted out, replaced by a vast screen flashing commercials and sports scores. The world churns forward as if none of us has lost what we love the most. I've been away from home for 8 days now, and suddenly the amount that I missed my own son ripped me open. He'd been so frail in that hospital bed, it was too late to call. Night fell over the glowing city, and still I walked. How do you love your child from a distance, from across the heavens, when none of you has passed into the other realm? My path led to the mall. It was open late. I bought a pair of tiny black suede sneakers to bring home to my son. I walked toward the hotel, toting this ridiculous purchase in a plastic sack that bounced with each step. Unworn child shoes. I was treading dark water now, longing for my first baby boy, who never wore shoes of any size, whose tiny feet had been inked and stamped onto a pad of paper by the kindly nurses, a memento that is now propped on our chest of drawers. Why can't we and our children be together? Months passed. I checked in with Mikhail and Dulcinea. They had received little word about their mother's case, except that their stepfather was still alive. The Las Vegas investigator told me that the police had interviewed him and that he fully cooperated. I found a few phone numbers for him, but they were disconnected or just kept ringing. The sisters had suffered enough to explode an entire planet. When I zoomed with Mikhail, she looked me in the eyes and said, there's a whole world out there, and we're just like ants on it. Or else we're tortoises trying to find a burrow, our mate, a patch of open desert to roam. Pam and Craig had told me in detail about the day they discovered Linda Sue Anderson. When they brought the police to the burial site, the cops set up a perimeter and asked the tortoise hunters to stay out while they combed the desert. Pam couldn't resist helping. From outside the police line, she hollered, oh, there's a bone to your left. As Pam and Craig remember it, the sergeant finally told the policemen to get out of the way and sent the biologists back in. They had sharp eyes and good instincts for finding signs of life and death. That's what turtle counters do. They see the essential things to which the rest of us are blind. Pam and Craig and Sally crossed the police line and located the rest of a mother's remains scattered across the sand. And if you have any information about the murder of Linda Sue Anderson, call the Crime Stoppers of Nevada tip line at 702-385-5555. And Mark Sundin's latest book, Delusions and Grandeur, Dreamers of the New West, will be published in February. He teaches environmental writing at the University of Montana. And next up, my first thru-hike wrecked my feet. Now I never trek without toe spacers. When our trail columnist first started sliding silicone spacers between his toes, friends chuckled, but now these little separators are getting the moment they deserve. This is by Grayson Haver Curran. In a previous lifetime, my idea of a long-distance hike was a music festival for 4 days. I prayed across dusty fields or clotted city streets, traipsing from stage to stage in pursuit of the next show. Who knows how many miles I clocked in these peripatetic bursts, but at that extended moment, a music critic in his 20s was way more committed to partying than pulmonary fitness. It was the exercise I knew best. Not long after I crossed the threshold into 30, though, that lifestyle caught up with me. Head west on the gay street in Knoxville, Tennessee, I sank onto the sidewalk and pulled off my boot, squeezing my left foot as though trying to force it back together. It was broken. I knew. A stress fracture from all these steps. Why else would each step now feel like another knife fight? As though someone were jamming a blade between my toes. I endured, switched into a pair of sneakers, and limped across around Tennessee until the festival's end. Back home, my symptoms suddenly subsided, appearing only sporadically during the next few years as I became obsessed with distance running. But in 2019, soon after I entered Maine, some 2,000 miles into a northbound thru-hike of the Appalachian Trail, that old ache returned. Was my foot broken? My hike done? Nope. After staying up late one night in an AT lean-to for a tailspin onto online medical sleuthing, I realized it was cuboid syndrome, when the pointy joint on the side of your foot shifts slightly out of line for a spell. With just enough bandwidth to stream a few video tutorials, I learned something called the cuboid squeeze and fixed it myself. But now I don't even need that technique. After 11,000 miles of hiking and countless more miles of road running in almost every state in the country, I simply never leave home without a 1.5-ounce piece of sculpted silicone that's changed my fitness and the way I travel. Toe spacers. Wait, what are toe spacers and why are they so popular? Toe spacers are having an unexpected moment. They are right now some 38 million TikTok videos that mention them. The Wall Street Journal has suggested they're a panacea. The New York Post notes they are transforming people's lives. Neurosurgeon and frequent TV medical commentator Sanjay Gupta, Philadelphia Eagles star Lane Johnson, body positive model Ashley Graham, they've all become advocates for a fitness craze I never expected to work in the late 2019 when I was desperate for anything to help me run again. After finishing the Appalachian Trail, my first long-distance hike, my body was a mess. Every attempt to return to running felt like another litany of physical insults. I'd already gone to multiple physical therapists and yoga classes trying to recover when a young pediatricist building custom inserts for my shoes took one look at my feet and told me I needed toe spacers. Bunions were forming on the sides of my feet, my little toe were starting to scrunch into claws or hammer toes. I needed, he said, to spread my toes back out after years of stuffing them into running and hiking shoes that squeezed them together. He pulled a clear zipper pouch from the wall and asked me to try them. Correct toes, curved ribs of silicone with three holes through which your middle toes slide. For the next several months, I wore them almost everywhere. Tucked between the toe socks, he'd also recommended inside shoes with wide toe boxes, like Topos or Ultras. I winced when I had to take my shoes off anywhere, knowing someone would inevitably exclaim, "What are those?" when they saw my spacers, but in the best way, my feet have never been the same again. Which toe spacers should I buy and try? As best as I can tell, Correct Toes, developed by a podiatrist and runner named Ray McClanahan, who I interviewed for Outside in 2022, are the most expensive models on the market at $65 per pair. They're also the only ones I've ever needed. Because they haven't warped or ripped after 5 years of sporadic use. More on sporadic in a bit. I never once resented what I paid. But there are more affordable options now. There's a $15 Correct Toes lookalike on Amazon, though some reviews there suggest you indeed pay for what you get. Primal Steps version for the same price looks more rugged, and I am certainly entertained by the idea of black toe spacers to match my endurance black toenails. Correct Toes occasionally slip out from between my digits, so I like the way Naboso splay and the foot's collective bright green wild toes wrap around all five. The inclusion of an exercise band is a welcome bonus, too. You can even try foot alignment socks with built-in toe spacers from Happy Feet. Though I'm slightly suspect of the oversized spacers that look more like toe bracelets from Yoga Toes for a reason I'll get into right now. So, how do I use toe spacers? I have to start slowly. Have you ever stretched a muscle for the first time in a while? Maybe because you notice a new stiffness in your body? It was uncomfortable, right? That's how toe spacers will feel for a bit, as you begin the business of prying apart bones, tendons, and ligaments that have been stuck inside narrow shoes for most of your life. I started with 15 minutes a day and gradually increased until I was wearing them almost all the time, taking care to remove them before I fell asleep. There's some suggestion that they restrict blood flow, especially at night. My toes simply feel stiff when I wake up with them still on. Yoga toes aren't appealing to me because they're too big to slip inside my shoes. These days, I don't use them all the time. My feet feel better because I've changed my entire routine. Foot socks always. Topo tennis shoes with wide toe boxes unless I'm dressing up. And regimen toe exercises using resistance bands. But whether I'm hiking across the country or going to do another music festival, I always have a single toe spacer in my bag ready to slot between my toes if my cuboid slips into position or slips its position, as it sometimes does, or my arches begin to ache as though they're on fire. I rarely travel with two toe spacers these days because both of my feet generally don't hurt all at the same time anymore. I spent years learning how to manage them after all. During a recent 1,200-mile trek along Wisconsin's Ice Age Trail, I would often end 30-mile days by wearing toe spacers in my tent, letting my toes stretch as I massaged my legs and made my dinner. I don't think you need to use toe spacers for the rest of your life. I do think, however, they can be crucial for taking care of the body part that actually makes contact with the ground and supports the rest of the body in the process. Do toe spacers actually work? Toe spacers have reached such critical mass of popularity that you can easily find opposing answers to this question, bandied about from San Francisco Gate to today. I'm not a doctor or foot health researcher, so I won't pretend to tell you anything prescriptive or definitive. But in the last 5 years or since I started using toe spacers, I have logged close to 20,000 miles on my feet, whether hiking long trails, running on roads, or yes, attending music festivals. I also turned 40, but I've rarely felt stronger as a hiker or a runner than I do right now. I've had no substantive problems with my feet in a long time. My knees are better too, and the knee pain was often linked with the foot to woes I experienced. Again, I've never seen toe spacers as a cure-all. I massage my feet, strengthen them, stretch them. But when they ache, whether I'm on a long hike or reporting trip in another city, a day with toe spacers is my first line of defense. It's perhaps the best $65 I ever spent on a piece of fitness gear. So much so, in fact, that I bought a second pair in alternate colors so that I can mix and match them as I travel. Hey, I've got to keep them looking surprising and ridiculous, since so many people now seem curious about what toe spacers are and if they can change how you feel too. And that was an article by Grayson Haver-Curran. You have been listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and I've been reading from Outside Magazine. My name is Dave Rogowski. Thank you for listening.